It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, we'll hear about efforts to track flu activity in Wisconsin.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the top news from Washington. The White House is continuing to face tough questions over its handling of a staffer who'd been accused of domestic abuse. That's got some people calling for the resignation of Chief of Staff John Kelly. Also, as part of the president's proposed budget, the food stamp program would be partially reworked into a meal delivery service. We're looking at those stories and more.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the White House's response to Staff Secretary Rob Porter's abuse allegations? Should someone be held accountable? And what are your thoughts on the food stamp program transitioning in part to delivery meal kits to low-income families? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org.
Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with former White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter. He recently resigned after reports came out that he physically abused his ex-wives. The White House is facing a lot of questions over how it handled Porter's employment, his background checks, and more. Can you spell out the story a little bit for us?
Sure. So Rob Porter, he's a top staffer. He's staff secretary in the White House, which basically means he sees every piece of paper that goes to the president's desk. He's a very close aide. And it ends up that he, you know, his ex-wives have come forward, said that he physically abused them. And there have been photos, too, showing what he did to one of his ex-wives. And the question is, what did the White House know? When did they know it? It's been clear that he has not been able to get security clearance. And the FBI now has said that it told the White House this on several occasions. The White House said that that information never got to top officials like the White House counsel and the White House chief of staff. But that timeline doesn't really work for a lot of people. There are reports that White House chief of staff John Kelly knew about the allegations for months. Kelly is saying that he didn't know how serious they were until he saw the pictures, and then he quickly told Porter he needed to go, but other people are disputing that. So it seems like John Kelly in particular, and also the White House counsel, seem to be stuck in this situation where they didn't maybe take this as seriously as they should have. They protected Rob Porter. And a lot of people within the White House are actually upset at the way it was handled.
Right. John Kelly, initially when the reports came out as chief of staff, had defended Porter, said very positive things about him. Also, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders read a statement that seemed supportive of him. And then after Porter was out, President Trump said what people read as very positive things about him without mentioning the victims of his alleged spousal abuse. What kind of criticism has there been since all of that?
Right. President Trump said that it's very sad what happened, and he meant sad what happened to Rob Porter, not sad what happened to the women. He never actually mentioned the women and never said that, you know, he hopes that they're okay. And he said that Porter did a great job. And he said he hopes he'll have a wonderful career. And then he made a point of mentioning it's important to note that Rob Porter has denied the allegations. And that's very important for everyone to keep in mind. That's what Donald Trump stressed, which, again, made a lot of people upset. The White House obviously does not have the best track record, starting with the president himself, when it comes to taking allegations by women on sexual harassment, sexual assault seriously. And here you have, you know, not just allegations, but photographic proof. And you have the president there saying he's a good guy, sad what's happening, he's leaving, but, you know, he says he's innocent, so maybe we should believe him. It's not, you know, it like I said, even within the White House, there are staffers who are saying, like, this is not good.
Advancing now to the last couple of days, earlier today, President Trump specifically said he condemns domestic abuse. And with the FBI timeline versus the White House timeline, here's Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I think this was yesterday, talking about why the FBI's findings didn't result in Porter being out of a job earlier.
The FBI portion was closed. The White House Personnel Security Office, who is the one that makes a recommendation for adjudication, had not finished their process and therefore not made a recommendation to the White House.
what questions are still open about the FBI's timeline versus the White House timeline?
Well, the FBI again said that we let the White House know. Did those concerns ever get up to the top levels? The White House says no. You know, the FBI hasn't clarified that. But it seems like, you know, again, Rob Porter has, you know, an outstanding pedigree. He's Ivy League educated. He's the son of a famous academic. He seemed like he was sort of this golden boy in the White House. And so was there an attempt to protect him? You know, in a lot of ways, he was sort of supposed to be one of the grown-ups in the White House. He wasn't causing all the drama that we hear from other people going on there. And so did people buy into that image too much and buy into the word of what this man was saying versus what his ex-wives were saying and protect him in a way that, you know, he shouldn't, you know, he committed these, he, you know, abused his ex-wives and shouldn't have been given a security clearance, shouldn't be in the White House. Did they just sort of look the other way because of his image?
And Congress is taking an interest. The House Oversight Committee today announced it'll be investigating the administration's hiring of Porter and the security clearances. Here's Republican Committee Chairman Trey Gowdy talking about what he wants to know.
Who knew what, when, and to what extent? And if you knew it in 2017 and the Bureau briefed him three times, then how in the hell was he still employed? The security clearance is a separate issue. I mean, it's an important issue, but it's separate. How do you have any job if you have credible allegations of domestic abuse?
So even some Republicans in Congress putting pressure on the White House here.
Absolutely. This is the condemnation so far has been bipartisan. And, you know, like I said, John Kelly trying to get a story out there that he acted immediately when he found out. President Trump's comments of, well, Porter says he's innocent, so maybe we got to believe him. Those have not gone over well, including with Republicans. I mean, domestic violence is not a partisan issue. And, you know, I think a lot of people are concerned that the White House maybe looked the other way on this and protected him.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post, where she's Washington bureau chief, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's turn now to the president's budget. A lot there, of course, increased spending for defense and border security, cuts to foreign aid and domestic programs. One thing, Amanda, that's gotten a lot of attention, a change in the food assistance program. What is the administration looking at doing here?
Sure. So right now, food stamps. It's known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, commonly known as food stamps. So if you're in that program, you basically get $125 approximately per person each month, a food voucher. And then you can use that as money. You can go to a grocery store and buy basically any food product. But the White House wants to change that. So if you get $90 or more per month in benefits, you'll get some of those benefits in the form of a food package. So you won't just get the voucher to spend. So you might get some sort of like ready to drink shelf stable milk, cereals, pasta, peanut butter, canned fruits and vegetables, meat, you know, things like that. So basically the federal government would be choosing what you eat instead of giving you money that you can then spend to decide what you want to eat. And so this is incredibly controversial. In a lot of ways, people say it's less efficient, and people are also finding it, honestly, a little bit judgmental because there's often this sort of criticism of people who are on food stamps that they're just buying junk food, that they're buying sugary snacks, that they're not spending their money in the way that people think they should be spending their money. When the evidence doesn't actually bear that out, they tend to buy the same food and the same mix of food that everyone else does. But you know, so this has a little bit of judgmental a side effect of it that, you know, if you are not poor enough to have enough money and you need this government help, we're going to pick the food that we think you should be eating.
I want to bring on a caller. Lisa is with us in Janesville. Lisa, hi.
Hi. How's it going? Thanks for taking my call. I am a food share recipient. And for the last 3 years, 2 years, we've had the state Senate wanting to tell me what to eat. We've had the federal government wanting to tell me what to eat. I mean, all of these entitlement programs are, there's constant government in my pocket, which I shouldn't say that. So I'm not saying that there needs to be some work on these programs. But the problem is A, what happens if you got people with dietary needs, has specific dietary needs, and they, or they're a vegetarian or anything else? Are we not allowed to do that. And the other thing is what we need to focus on, rather than choosing what people have to do, why don't we focus on education? And instead of requiring, you know, recipients not to smoke drugs or take pizza, how about if we just educate people on how to eat nutritionally, how to shop nutritionally and economically, instead of just take our things away from us?
Lisa, thanks for the call. I want to bring on another caller, Matthew in Western Wisconsin. Matthew, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks. Good. What do you think about this?
Well, touching on what Lisa just said, in addition to the special dietary requirements, I mean, it makes a little bit of sense in larger metropolitan areas like Milwaukee, Racine, Madison, those types of areas, to where this program could potentially at least help people. But in rural areas, like rural Wisconsin, where a lot of low-income families might get SNAP benefits, but they only go to the grocery store, say, once a week or once every 2 weeks. In certain areas, there isn't even like the Meals on Wheels program for senior citizens. And touching on that, how are these going to get delivered to them? Also with the nutrition, I mean, it might cut down the cost in the short term for the generalized Joe Schmo package that gets put out to people. But like Lisa said, with special dietary requirements, it's going to astronomically increase the cost if you have to specialize each individual meal plan and meal package to a family or an individual.
Gotcha, Matthew. I want to bring Amanda back in. Are we hearing some objections to this, as we heard from Lisa and Matthew here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the notion that people who may be low income can't decide for themselves what's best for them and their families, again, is just incredibly judgmental, and it's making these sort of value decisions that I don't think are fair and that the evidence doesn't bear out. You know, dietary restrictions are a great point. Or what if, you know, you get a bunch of green beans that month and you just don't like green beans? You know, why should, and you know, you, that is taking away from your allotment. You know, this is a government benefit, and people should be able to spend the money on the food that they think fits their family. You know, maybe there's a sale and they want to stock up on something. So there's a lot of pushback to this, and it didn't help that the White House referred to it as a sort of blue apron approach. And you know, it's nothing like blue apron. Blue apron is sort of a program where you get ingredients for gourmet meals, not boxes of canned goods and shelf-stable milk. And, you know, the point is to make it more convenient for your cook. I mean, this is, it's not at all, and that comparison just isn't going over well. It's not helping the government's case.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, looking at the top stories in national news.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. After another court ruling blocked the Justice Department from ending the DACA program in March, do you think it should continue? What solution would you like to see Congress come up with for DACA recipients? And are you concerned about hacking and election interference from countries such as Russia? Do you think more should be done to address it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our talk with Amanda Turkle. She's the Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post. She's with us to talk about the biggest news from Washington.
Coming up, we'll get to some legislative election results around the country, Russian hacking, and more. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. DACA, Amanda, the program that protected people brought into the country illegally as minors. The president said he's ending the program. Congress is working on this March 5th deadline, and now a federal judge in New York blocked the Trump administration from ending the program. Another judge now, the second ruling against the plan. What is the latest?
So right now, yeah, a second judge has blocked it, and the government is trying to appeal it. But if the Supreme Court doesn't want to take up the case, there's a good chance that it is blocked. And it's not the government's, the Trump administration has the power to end the program. But the issue is whether they can bar people who are already in the program from renewing their applications and getting to stay in the country. So the question now is the Supreme Court going to take it up and appeal, and will the government have another chance?
And Congress now has this big task in front of it. They were working on some kind of deal to keep DACA recipients in the country and do other stuff with immigration, border security, and more. Are they looking at this court ruling and saying, oh, okay, we've got longer, or are they still plowing ahead on this?
They are still plowing ahead, and they say they are, but, you know, in the back of their minds, they're looking at this and seeing that they might have a little bit more time. I mean, immigration advocates for quite a while have been saying, like, look, you think you have until March, but people are not able to renew before then. This is actually much more urgent than it seems, and Congress generally hasn't really seemed to have any urgency. So immigration is something that they're working on right now, but to be honest, they're not close to a deal. It's not clear that the Senate and the House can come up with something that they agree on. It's not clear whether even the Senate can come up with something, which is where a lot of the action is right now. So they are working on it, but it right now it doesn't look great for a deal.
And the president's looking for cutbacks in currently legal forms of immigration, funding for the border wall. And he, as I understand it, says he would veto a bill that strayed too far from what he wants. Is that right?
Right. As I was saying, you know, you have differences between the parties, differences between the chambers, and like you point out, you have a difference with the president. And some of what the president is demanding, like these changes to legal immigration programs, Democrats just say are non-starters, and they're not going along with that.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post about some of the top stories in national politics right now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And we will go to a caller now. We've got Ruben on the line in Madison. Ruben, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What do you think, Ruben?
So I'm an immigrant myself, and I just wanted to make a couple of comments. It's not as easy as people think. A lot of times in the news and the media, you think, why didn't these people get it together in the first place? Because a lot of times it takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of paperwork. You got to pay lawyers to go through the process. You know, you're not attorneys to go through the immigration process. So it's not as black and white and as easy as it a lot of people think. Why did they didn't get it together a long time ago? So. Sometimes it can take easily 10, 15 years before you're finally able to get to a place where you're a permanent resident alien and then a citizen. The other comment real quick I want to make is that a lot of times I'll see comments in the news or in social media from other immigrants who are now citizens or who maybe were political refugees and received asylum at some point or another for some political reason who say, hey, they didn't get it together. I paid my dues. I went through the legal way and they should as well. Well, the expression I was used as well, black and white Americans showed you empathy and allowed, you know, for you to be in this country in the first place, you know. So that's the same empathy that these individuals are looking for, you know. Nobody cares if you're undocumented and a criminal. Yeah, everybody's agreement, deport those. But people who are contributing to the economy, contributing to society, you know, the same empathy that some of these other immigrants for various reasons or situations were allowed, you know, a path to citizenship.
Ruben, I'm going to jump in because we don't have too much time. Amanda, is Ruben on track with what some Democrats are saying in this debate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think empathy is something that you don't hear necessarily a lot in the debate in Washington about this. You do from some supporters of the Dreamers, obviously. And, you know, that's part of why the Dreamer movement has been so powerful is that these young people are people, you know, I think, you know, individuals who aren't even involved in the immigration debate at all can really relate to and how hard it would be for them to be sent back to these countries that they don't know.
Ruben, thanks for that call. Amanda, I want to get to a couple more issues in national news. First, intelligence leaders are warning of more Russian hacking ongoing now, efforts to sway now the 2018 election. Want to give a listen to Dan Coats, National Director of Intelligence, talking to the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Frankly, the United States is under attack by entities that are using cyber to penetrate virtually every major action that takes place in the United States.
And did other intelligence leaders agree with Coates on this?
Yes, it is a major concern for the intelligence leaders. It's already happening for 2018. You know, obviously we saw this in 2016. And you know, the country is not completely prepared for it. A lot of it is through this sort of misinformation campaign, you know, using digital strategies, social media to basically divide the country more, to get both sides. You know, you hear all the time about how Americans are so divided, and that's true. And that would probably be true without election interference from, you know, Russia or whatever. But it certainly doesn't help when you have these bad actors coming in and artificially inflating those tensions. And so they're worried about that, and they're worried about, you know, other cybersecurity threats. But it's a big issue, and I think that, you know, as they said, we're just not prepared for them.
Finally, Amanda, people are watching a state legislative special elections around the country, trying to find tea leaves for the big elections this fall. Last week had a result in Missouri, yesterday in Florida. What are we seeing?
Well, it's been Donald Trump's presidency has been very good in getting elected, getting Democrats elected. So on Tuesday, Democrats flipped their 36th legislative seat, state legislative seat, since Trump won the presidency. So those are seats that were in Republican control and that Democrats have now won. Republicans, meanwhile, have flipped just four. So that's a big, big difference. And Republicans have traditionally been far more dominant at the state level. They still are. But this is very troubling that for Republicans that Democrats are taking these Republican seats, and many of them are in districts that Trump won pretty big.
We'll leave it there for now. Amanda, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Amanda Turkle. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. She joined us for our weekly look at some of the top national stories in politics.